Well, Anthony, great to be with you. Here we are backstage with Catalyst Labs. And earlier today, you spoke to our audience and this theme of being present, yet you are an expert on a host of issues, race, hip-hop, a lot of current culture issues. I didn't get to hear your lab, and I want our folks who are listening in from around the world who didn't get to hear it, give us a summary of what you shared with our audience.
Yeah, very basically, I have very strong interest in social justice. I'm primarily interested in social justice being driven and motivated, organized on the basis of love. Jesus makes it really clear that the greatest thing that a person can do as a follower of Christ is to love God and love neighbor. I think love should be the primary hermeneutic for understanding what justice is. And so we have to think about justice in terms of what does it mean to love human beings according to the ways in which God calls us in the scriptures to love people. So human dignity becomes an important part of understanding what does it mean to love people who are made in the image and likeness of God. So I talked about love, talked about human dignity, I talked about solidarity, the sense that we're all in this together, right? That because we're human beings, we share a common humanity. So we care about injustice across the world and our neighborhoods because those are people that Jesus has called us not just to throw money at, but to actually love affectionately, right? And so we need to start asking better questions about what does it mean to love human beings who are made in God's image according to the way God wants them to be loved, not necessarily the ways in which we think they need to be loved, because sometimes good intentions can undermine human dignity. So we need to think about what do people need, what do they really deserve, what's it mean to be treated equally, and how do we create context where there's real reciprocity, the idea that we're going to pass on the blessing that's been given to us. So I was kind of helping people think about the ways in which we can create those categories that produce opportunities for human flourishing and loving people according to what it means for them to be made in the image and likeness of God. Again, motivated by loving God and loving neighbor, because those pioneers of social justice were people who were changed from the inside out. And so the gospel changes people in such a way that it orders their justice in a way that's in harmony with God's own will for the world.
You know, that's so eloquently stated. And our audience, very familiar with social justice and why we should be doing justice, yet I feel like there's a bit of a gap that we as the church don't necessarily cross. We know what should be, we know what could be, but sometimes we don't actually really engage the way we should. And I guess you're a man who's well-read, well-studied, and you're on the front line of many different forms of justice. How would you weigh in on that, to the question of will we see abject poverty in the last two decades, yeah, go from 50% of the world's population to 52 to 26. Can we see the broad scope of sexual slaves and sure, so forth and so on? Can we see that stamped out in our lifetime?
Yeah, and it has a lot to do, again, with Jesus' command to love God and love neighbor. I mean, I just think that's a better hermeneutic than the Great Commission, right? The Great Commission is actually not in the Bible. There's no verse that says Great Commission, but there is a verse that talks about the greatest thing that we can do, the greatest commandment, which is love God and love neighbor. Here's how these things will be stamped out. The loving God part really does emphasize the need for continued evangelism, missions, church planting, the moral formation of culture. If you want sex slavery to end, you have to change the social mores of people who are participants in that industry, right? It's a supply-demand issue, right? It's because you have men whose morals are disordered that they want girls underage to have sex with and pay for them. So unless there's missions and gospel preaching and church planting, those social mores are not going to be changed in ways that create different types of demand. The loving neighbor part is really important as well. It's because we love our neighbor that we want to rescue victims and take them out of situations that actually are harmful to them because they're human beings. So we have to have there has to be a collaboration between church planting, gospel-centered missions, and people who are concerned about those who are hurting. I think that we'll see radical change if both of those things happen, not just one or the other, right? Not just church planting and missions, and not just sort of social justice nonprofit programs, but you have to really affect the culture, the mores of the culture, if you want to see those sorts of changes happen. And there has to be structures that allow the kind of economic engine and freedom and creativity that allow people to take care of themselves. Because aid is not a long-term solution to poverty. Employment is. So what do we have to do to set up structures that create jobs and create wealth? Because that's the only solution to poverty in the long term is jobs. Mm. Mm. Not aid.
Mm. Mm. That's true. I want to switch gears and talk about race. It's always a very uncomfortable topic, I guess. Depends on who you talk to. But in reality, it's always going to be an issue when you have different races that live together and we have majority, minority. And you and I were talking before the interview. Increasingly, we are a brown country, whether that be Latino. And we saw data released recently that even evangelicals have less and less problem with mixed marriages, all types of things that, you know, just lead to we see good things happening. But you write about race. You're an African-American scholar, a great thinker. I'm just curious. I don't want my head to be in the sand. I've adopted two biracial boys. But how would you, as a young African-American, how would you describe race between the white and the black community as we sit here in 2011?
That's a great question. You know, here in 2011, we continue to suffer from the separate institutions that emerged from slavery. And unfortunately, because both the white church, broadly described, and the black church developed for centuries their own culture, own denominational structures that parallel each other, there is virtually no solidarity, there's no unity, there's no relationship. We don't even know each other, right? So often when I ask some of my friends who organize conferences, hey, why don't you invite more black pastors? And they're like, well, who? And I'm thinking, well, how do you not know? And I'll run down the list, and like, I never heard of these guys before. And then vice versa, right? We just don't know each other. So for me, the first problem is a relational one, right? People don't have interracial relationships. And I fundamentally believe that the church isn't going to look any differently. It's not going to look any different until our personal lives look different. Often it's often, I think, misunderstood that if you create diverse churches on Sunday, it'll affect Monday through Saturday. And I'm thinking, actually, it's the opposite. It's not that Sunday is the most 11 a.m. is the most segregated hour of the week. It's actually between 5 and midnight every day, Monday through Saturday, is the most segregated hour of the week, because that's when people who work in integrated spaces retreat back to their own subcultures every evening. Right? And I challenge people, look at the pictures on your refrigerator, and that'll tell you about your commitment to racial unity and racial diversity. Look at your wedding photo. Right? Who are you friends with? Okay? We go to church with people who are like us, people that we can relate to, people that we often are in relationship with. And so if there's going to be an emphasis on relationships, then the diversity part of the relationship piece has to also take place. But the cart before the horse is thinking the church has to change and then our personal lives change, and it's actually the opposite. So today, 2011, although we share interracial workspace, interracial worship space, we still don't really share interracial, multi-ethnic social space. And I think that's the hump that we have to cross over before we can make real progress.
And when you make that statement, you mean as a whole. The data would imply that we still have pretty much segregated, you know, you're not hanging out with them at your neighborhood parties. You're not, if you're a black, you're not hanging out with a white, and so forth, so
right.
on. It's still relatively,
Go to any bar on a weekend. There's black bars. There's Latino bars. There's bars where Asian Americans hang out. You just don't see the mix. It's the social space.
Right.
Right. Who do you hang out with?
Yeah,
who are you suffering with?
Right.
Right. When you need to make a call at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Because your house burnt. Who do you call?
That's right.
Right. That's the space where we have to have more integration. And the most radical thing, I would say that if Christians really wanted to radically stand out as committed to diversity, we would lead the nation in interracial marriages to sort of make the case about the kingdom.
Yeah.
And it's diversity in the future.
Well, and just a practical note here, I think actually interracial marriages just produce beautiful children, period. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And I think it's God's kind of little, this is not theological and it won't hold any theological water, but it is amazing that when we see interracial marriages, sometimes the most beautiful people come out of that. That has always intrigued me. But I want to stay on this note. And we were talking again before we started recording. I think this is important because as leaders, if they're going to accept a challenge like you just stated, and they're going to lead churches that are ministering and reaching all people, this Latino population, they're not going to build a wall anytime soon. And so we can continue to see that population explode. Many reputable media sources have said that within a decade from when we sit right here, Latinos will be the majority population in numbers in the United States. You're a forward thinker. I'm sure you've thought through this. What do you see as potential landmines socially? And then how does the church maybe get on the front edge of that? What can they anticipate?
Well, I mean, I think what will really be interesting is that evangelicalism, as it currently is constructed as a culture, right? Primarily white, evangelical, suburban culture, even though there's sort of the missional hipster people who occupy cities, still for the most part, it's still sort of predominantly white. They're going to be pushed to the margins in terms of being an influential group in terms of their impact, their import on Christianity here in America. What's interesting about these immigrant subdominant cultures is they actually don't need evangelical resources to be thriving Christian communities. And so there's going to be some marginalization, which may create even more separation. And I think that it will actually challenge, require the normal white evangelical culture to be listeners and to be recipients rather than to consider themselves sort of leaders of Latinos, right? For the first time, white evangelicals need to sit in a subordinate position as listeners and learners, asking how can we help, how can we be of service? You tell us what to do, as opposed to coming in and saying, okay, here's the deal, right? Here's how you do church, here's how you do music, here's how you do this and this and this and this, according to our standards, right? And there's not going to be a lot of mixing and change until leaders begin to model in their own personal lives that they care about diversity. So we can't expect the church person sitting in the pew or the chair or the floor, depending on what kind of church you're in, right? Live their own lives in such a way that models opening up, welcoming some of the new diverse changes that are happening demographically in our culture, if they don't see leaders doing it. So if pastors are not, if they don't see pastors and church staff and elders and deacons in relationships with blacks and Hispanics, if they don't see that sort of Latino connection, then they're not going to see it in the church. And so this is really an opportunity for leaders. It's almost a call for leaders to be proactive in building bridges and relationships by taking a subordinate position and saying, we have resources, we're here to serve you, but you tell us what to do. We're not going to tell you how to do anything. You tell us how we can serve you. And we're not coming saying we have the answers, right? We have more questions than we have answers. And we're going to open ourselves up to being led by. See, this will be different in the future of evangelicalism in America. Evangelicalism is going to die if its leaders are not diverse. And so in the future, evangelical leaders today are actually going to need to step aside and let African-American and Asian and Latino leaders actually lead the future of evangelicalism for demographic reasons alone, right? Latino population growing, white population shrinking, black population stagnant, Asian American population growing, right? That's how the demographics are actually working. So in the long run, if evangelicalism has a future in terms of leadership, it's going to have to be led by the vibrant minority leaders who are currently leading those subdominant cultures in the country right now. That's going to be a huge challenge for evangelical leaders to say, we need to step aside and be led by some Mexicans who just moved into our county. We need to be led by some of these Jamaican immigrant communities and things like that. Huge, huge shift.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that it almost sounds like impossible as you say it, you know, yeah. Based on our current framework. A lot to think about there. He is Anthony Bradley, and on behalf of Catalyst, our entire audience, thanks for stopping by and sharing a bit of your heart and mind. Great thinker, great young leader, and a voice you need to make sure that you are paying attention to. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.